Greg Bordonero is the editor of the Hartford Business Journal, and we welcome him to the program today. Greg, welcome to Front and Center.
Thanks for having me.
Number of interesting stories in the latest printed edition of the Hartford Business Journal, and you can also visit their website, hartfordbusiness.com. One of the stories that caught my eyes, Greg, was this story about how the state of Connecticut and the gas industry had embarked on this $7 billion gas expansion plan, and oil prices have collapsed, and that's really affected a lot of things, hasn't it?
Sure. Yeah, so in 2014, the state partnered with the utilities to launch a $7 billion 10-year effort to convert approximately 280,000 utility customers to natural gas. But the plan's success really hinged on federal government projections that oil prices would essentially climb for the next decade or more. So 10 years, they were projecting higher oil prices. And, of course, this was a time when, you know, gas prices were high, oil prices were high. And nobody thought that the market, the oil market, would sort of tank, which it did immediately in 2014, basically 6 months after this program kicked off. And so right now, the utilities are slightly behind on their efforts to convert, to make these conversions. Their goal is 280,000 conversions within 10 years. Right now, they're behind those projections. It's not exactly clear how far behind they are. They don't have, they have year-by-year projections, but they've altered them in the first few years because of the low oil prices. However, they're projecting the pace will pick up. But right now, they're behind schedule, and, you know, nobody really predicted these oil prices dropping so quickly, but they have. And the big problem for this program is that basically lower gas prices is making it less attractive financially for people to switch over to natural gas. And because you basically, to switch to natural gas, you have to make an upfront investment into it. For an individual residential taxpayer, you have to invest about $7,500, and that's mainly converting to new equipment. For a regular commercial or industrial customer, you have to invest about $20,000 to $40,000 to make this conversion to natural gas. So with oil prices being so low, the payback for ratepayers is a lot longer than it was under the original plan. Originally, people who made the conversion could expect to save $800 per year going to natural gas, but that's much lower now.
Also, what caught my eye is when they sold this concept to the people, they also sold it on the premise that it would give the state's GDP a boost, and that hasn't happened, has it?
You know, it's too early to tell exactly. This thing was created for two reasons. One, to help lower greenhouse gas emissions long term, and also as a major economic stimulus. In late 2011, two economists at the state level calculated that the expansion of natural gas to 280,000 new customers would result in a net $4.1 billion increase in state GDP over the life of the program. It's not clear what financial impact it has had so far. But since they're behind the pace of conversions right now, it's certainly probably not having as big of an impact as it was originally anticipated.
Are the proponents of this conversion still upbeat that down the road, long term, this will be the way to go?
Yeah, utilities say that, you know, they're off to a bit of a slow start, but they're confident that they're going to reach their original goals, which for Eversource is about 82,000 customers, and then for United Aluminum, which is now Avangrid, they're saying they can pick up the rest of that to get to the 280,000. So they expect things to pick up with oil prices so low right now. Things are slow, but even the state, the Department of Energy and Environmental Protection, they're still confident that they'll be able to hit the 280,000 mark. And whether they do remains to be seen. It also depends on how oil prices react going forward. Right now, there's no signals that oil prices are going to suddenly spike again. So it's sort of a wait-and-see approach.
Talking with Greg Bordonero, editor of the Hartford Business Journal, and one of the stories that caught my eye, and you helped co-write it, has to do with the untaxed property list for the city of Hartford. This is an eye-opener, Greg.
Yeah, well, you know, the city has always sort of used the not necessarily an excuse, but the fact that there's a huge amount of untaxed property in the city within the city borders, and that's, you know, that hurts their economic standing because they don't have a large property base to tax and bring in property tax revenues, which of course we all know is the lifeblood of municipal and city governments. So we took a deep analysis of the 2015 Graham list to try to figure out precisely how much real estate in the city is taxed. Traditionally, it's around 50%. We hear it's around 50%, but we actually found it's closer to 60%. And that's just the real estate. That doesn't include personal property taxes or motor vehicles. And so of the $6.5 billion of assessed real estate within the city of Hartford, we found that 59% of it is untaxed because its owners are nonprofits or tax-exempt entities. And of that, about $3.8 billion in tax-exempt property that we found, the city owns nearly 30% of it, which is interesting because, you know, the city raises the concerns that there's a lot of tax-exempt property within their borders. They actually own a significant percentage of it. So, you know, one of the things we wanted to do here is figure out what are the options for the city to get more taxable property on its tax rolls, and there's no easy answers for that. The other major property owners, tax-exempt property owners in the city, of course, is the state. They own about $840 million in assessed real estate that's tax-exempt, and also hospitals, they own about $690 million combined in tax-exempt real estate. Colleges and universities hold about $371 million in untaxed real estate. And then churches, charitable organizations, and the federal government also own hundreds of millions of dollars in untaxed real estate. So this is a big problem for the city. You know, the only way that they're going to get out of this financial crisis that they're in is if they expand their tax base. Of course, their options are limited because so much property is in the hands of entities that don't pay taxes.
Well, the mayor's trying to push this regionalization concept, isn't he?
Yeah, you know, the mayor has been very active since he's been elected, even before he was elected, that he thinks that the way the system is currently set up will not work for the city of Hartford. And if the city of Hartford is in continued financial crisis, it's going to reflect poorly on the other cities and towns in the region here. And what she's probably right about. So he's been active trying to convince other towns, other cities that a regional approach is better. He's floated the idea of a regional sales tax, things like that, or shared services that'll actually bring in a lot more significant savings. And so in this upcoming legislative session, I expect, you know, the mayor and the Hartford delegation to propose some sort of regional, I don't know exactly what it will be, but some sort of legislation that'll call for a regional approach. What it is and how widespread or how in-depth it'll be remains to be seen, but he's been aggressive on this, and I expect him to propose something pretty sweeping with respect to how city government and town government is run in Connecticut. Whether it'll have support remains to be seen. You know, I think you're going to have a hard time still convincing suburbs to pay up more money to help fund the city of Hartford. At the same respects, you know, a lot of people work in the city but don't live here, so they use city services, either getting here on you know, to transport for work. They drive here for work. They use other city services. They use downtown restaurants and things like that. So there's an argument to be made that the whole region should contribute more to help the city of Hartford itself.
Has there been any thought or conversation among city fathers about selling off the 30% of the property or some of the 30% of the property the city owns?
So we talked to the city about that. We talked to Jamie Bratt, who's their sort of economic development director. And, you know, he basically said the city sort of takes a measured approach as to which properties they sell or develop because they don't want to create a future space shortage. Or they don't want to push properties on the tax rolls in an already soft commercial real estate market, so there are challenges. Now, the city has made attempts to sell off properties. Remember, 2 years ago, the city sold off about 6.5 acres off Jennings Road in the North Meadows to Springfield's Pride Convenience, which is creating a truck stop there. There's more land in that North Meadows area that some people think that the city should continue to sell off for private development. In 2013, the city sold off its Morgan Street parking garage to the state for $23.5 million. Of course, that didn't bring it back to the tax rolls. And then they sold off the Church Street garage for $14 million last year. So there has been instances of the city selling off assets, but you also don't want to sell assets just for a quick return to help fill you know, budget gaps, which the city did when it sold off some of its parking garages a few years ago. And it was interesting too because the city says that even if the city sold off all of its marketable real estate, it still wouldn't solve the city of Hartford's budget crisis. So that just goes to show you how deep of a mess the city is in. And of course, they have to be careful when you're selling off real estate. The city sold off real estate, for example, for this Dunkin' Donuts stadium project, and you know, you see how that project has gone. So the city has a sort of a spotty track record in terms of selling off city-owned land for private development and how those private developments come out.
There's another interesting story today about paid sick leave in the state of Connecticut, and apparently it has had a negative effect on a certain demographic. What can you tell us about that?
Sure. So Connecticut's paid sick leave was passed by the legislature in 2011. It took effect in 2012. The law basically requires non-manufacturing companies with 50 or more workers to provide an hour of paid leave to employees for every 40 hours worked. And so, you know, this is the paid sick leave is a major national sort of policy idea. More and more Democratic or liberal policymakers want to pass this in other states and other cities. Connecticut passed its version in 2012, becoming one of the first states to pass this type of law. And the Employment Policies Institute, which is a pro-industry group that does a lot of analysis on public policy that impacts employers, they released a study on August 1st that found that workers between the ages of 20 to 34 have been impacted the most by this particular law. In terms of they're seeing fewer hours worked during the year and lower pay. It's not a huge amount. Those workers basically have seen a 24-hour reduction in the number of hours they work per year and an $850 hit in income as a result of the law, which amounts to about a 1.5% and 3.5% decline, respectively. The study found that the impact on the overall working population has been less pronounced. So it hasn't been a huge impact. This is just one of the early studies to try to gauge its impact.
Well, what I find interesting, and I could be getting my nonprofit groups based in Washington, D.C. mixed up. There's so many of them.
Sure.
And I've always thought that EPI was one of these groups that pushed policies such as paid sick leave. For them to come out with this study, even though it's an early stage study, to me is surprising, Greg.
Yeah, I mean, their study, although it was, you know, it was less pronounced, but they're basically saying that this policy is cutting hours for employers, which is a significant thing. People who were against paid sick leave, including the business lobby in Connecticut, raised this as a concern, and certainly it's having that impact right now. And, you know, I think we're going to have to wait to see a longer time frame for the study to see how it is. There was also a 2015 study that found that the law, Connecticut's law, resulted in a 0.9% increase in the fraction of unemployed workers in the state. So it certainly is apparently having some sort of impact on the economy. But also this study also didn't take into account what sort of positives is created by a law like this for workers. You're going to see this issue studied a lot in the next few years, especially as other states begin to adapt these laws, which we'll probably see.
Finally, some upbeat news. The Travelers Championship produced a lot of money for area charities, right?
Yeah, $2.8 million, which was a record-setting year. Obviously, Travelers, which is played at the TPC in Cromwell, it's Connecticut's biggest sporting event of the year. Travelers has done a great job over the last 10 or so years since they took on the sponsorship of it. It continues to get lots of attention. Unfortunately, this year it sort of bumped into the Olympics, and it came at the end of the PGA Tour season because of the Olympics, but it was still a great event. I spent a couple of days there. The crowds were very good again, and yep, they raised $2.8 million, and the lead charity this year is the Hospital for Special Care and their ALS research and treatment for patients. Of course, Travelers' former CEO, Jay Fishman, was diagnosed with ALS about a year ago, and because of that, Travelers really focused their attention on trying to raise money for that effort.
You know, when you think about it, though, Greg, even though its place on the tournament calendar wasn't the best this year, it turned out to be one of the best tournaments. You had so many storylines. Jim Furyk, of course, with the 58 yesterday. Russell Knox wins the tournament, beats out former University of Hartford player Jerry Kelly by a stroke. Just an exciting tournament.
Yeah, I mean, this is the PGA Tour has said year in and year out that Travelers is one of the most, players look forward to this tournament the most because of the great condition of the course, the way, you know, the hometown crowd treats players, the way Travelers treats players. This is sort of one of the big pride points for the state of Connecticut, and every year it gets a lot of support, a lot of attention. There's a lot of great sponsors in addition to Travelers who help support it and put money into it. And so it was just it was another good year for the tournament, and you know, Travelers is committed to this tournament for years to come now. So it's a great thing for the city of for Cromwell, but you know, this is really the whole Greater Hartford region and the state that benefits from this.
Well, very informative as always, Greg. Thanks for spending some time with us. You have yourself a great week, and we'll talk again down the road.
All right, thank you.
You're welcome, Greg Bordonero, the editor of the Hartford Business Journal.